On the evening of September 11th, President Bush, I think it was the evening of September 11th, spoke of the United States as being at war. Most Americans agreed with the president, though some, like Susan Sontag, have argued that with an intangible enemy and few overt acts of terrorism, this war was really metaphorical rather than real. Perhaps, but if there was one place that war was not a metaphor, it was Lower Manhattan, which looked, sounded, and smelled like a war zone in the weeks after September 11th. And beyond the physical signs of destruction, the intensity of the emotions it provoked, the way it dominated the lives and conversations of all New Yorkers, is very similar to how I think a war dominates people who live through it. Arthur Danto, writing in The Nation, he's speaking of artists, said a very deep piece of art history can be written about what New York artists did in the months when we thought and talked about nothing else, and the enormity of our shared experience flooded consciousness. I think that's true for artists. I think it's true for all New Yorkers. And I think one of the most important tasks in beginning to create a history of what happened on September 11th is trying to reconstruct and sequence the reactions of New Yorkers in the days and weeks after the event, when everybody's attention was focused on it and just about nothing else. Robert Snyder, who is director of the journalism program at Rutgers Newark, will be speaking about this. Rob is a historian whose book on vaudeville, The Voice of the City, was published by Oxford University Press. And let me get Rob.
Thank you. One of the things that is most important to understand when we look at cultural reactions to 9/11 in New York City is to understand the way people brought together elements of their past and their present to forge a response to this enormous catastrophe. In the aftermath of 9/11, the reigning cliche was that everything has changed, but I'm not sure at all that that was true. In ordinary times, New York City is often depicted as a city that's consecrated to the future, as a city that forgets its past and relentlessly steps forward into tomorrow. I think this perspective is deeply mistaken, and it certainly doesn't explain the cultural reaction to 9/11. Because even as New Yorkers moved into the morning of September 12th, and as they do this in their everyday experience before and after this catastrophe, they never entirely escape from their past. The presence of history in the weight of the physical city and the cultural inheritance wrought by previous generations is very real in New York City, very palpable in many of the city's neighborhoods. In the colonial streets of the financial district in Lower Manhattan, in the New Deal liberalism that remains a stubbornly enduring element in the city's increasingly conservative political culture, and in the ethnic layering of neighborhoods of old and new immigrants in all sections of New York. This mingling of past and present, of blending old cultural elements with new ones to confront a new situation, was very prominent in New Yorkers' reactions to 9/11. In the immediate aftermath of the attack on the World Trade Center, in realms of media, mourning, and memory, New Yorkers reached into their past and combined elements of it with tools from the present to make sense of an enormous tragedy. They didn't depart from their history, but they chose to carry forward certain elements of their history that would sustain them in an uncertain present. All of these were on display, I would argue, in the newspapers of New York City in the days immediately after 9/11. Newspapers are the oldest form of mass media in the city. And in the aftermath of 9/11, they played both old and new roles to cope with the crisis. They displayed old and new cultural reforms in response to 9/11. I woke up in Manhattan on the morning of September 12th and went to the corner of 86th Street and Lexington Avenue, where I'd normally be able to buy a newspaper. I could not buy a newspaper because people were buying them as fast as they could. As quickly as they arrived on the newsstand, they were being grabbed up. There were some extra copies of the Post lying around, but the Times, the Daily News, and Newsday were being swept up very, very quickly. Downtown, a friend of mine who lives in the East Village saw the same thing, saw a woman walking down 2nd Avenue, clutching a copy of the New York Times, saying loudly to anyone who could hear her, "The Times, the Times, at least we have the Times." In Harlem, Les Payne, the editor of New York's Newsday, saw the same thing as he tried to find a copy of his newspaper on the newsstands. He assumed they hadn't been delivered. They had been delivered, but they had been purchased almost immediately. Well, why? Certainly in an event that had been witnessed live on television by so many people, in which so many reports had gone out on the web, people were not necessarily looking for information when they looked to their newspapers. The facts of the event, I suspect, were quite clear in their minds already. What they were looking for, in addition to information, was a kind of forum, a medium grounded in the specific place where they lived that could help them make sense of the event as they experienced it. Not the network television system, which has always been national in its orientation, the American Broadcasting Corporation, the Columbia Broadcasting System, the National Broadcasting Corporation, but rather newspapers that were more locally oriented, the New York Times, the New York Post, the Daily News, Newsday. In this role as local forum, newspapers were fulfilling an old function that they had carried out at least since the 19th century. But they gave this function a new form, particularly when they tried to deal with the enormity of the catastrophe itself. Reports departed from the detached omniscient stance of 20th century American journalism, governed by an ethic of objectivity, and instead presented in the immediate day after the crisis the stories of survivors. Again and again, New York newspapers printed the stories of survivors as central elements in their coverage of the catastrophe. It was as if the entire story was too big to be encompassed in one narrative and had to be understood from multiple perspectives brought to the paper by the stories of individuals who had survived the crash. The expertise to be found was frequently in the stories of survivors who had been close to the events in the streets of Lower Manhattan as they occurred. And reporters shared their authority with them on the pages of the newspaper, often presenting these stories with very little mediation so that the direct voice of the survivor could speak and explain the size of what had happened. Newspapers wrapped these survivors' stories in a kind of mantle of solidarity that sought to link New Yorkers in a mood of both danger and patriotism. At this worst, this could become a kind of inhibition of dissent and a muffling of dissent. At the same time, on the reverse side of that, this kind of journalism could create a mood of shared crisis, of shared concern, of a collective dilemma that all of us as individuals faced. But the stories that came out in the days afterwards addressed this collective crisis without forgetting the deaths of individuals. And indeed, it is this need to recall the deaths of individuals as individuals that emerges as one of the hallmarks of newspaper responses to 9/11. The New York Times' Portraits in Grief is only the best known and probably best executed of these kinds of series of articles. Again and again and again, in New York City newspapers and in newspapers around the region, in New Jersey, in Long Island, and in Westchester, stories depicted the lives and deaths of individuals lost on 9/11. Portraits, in particular, departed from the conventional omniscient perspective of an obituary that tries to sum up a life in all of its detail in sequence, and instead presented stories of lives interrupted, of broken narratives. Now, the New York Times Portraits in Grief has been criticized by some journalists for being saccharine, for not being tough enough. Nevertheless, I also think that Portraits in Grief blended new elements of journalistic practice with old applications of an appreciation for ordinary people that was an essential element in the city's New Deal political culture. Marshall Berman has made this point, that the portraits in grief were an exercise in what he calls plain manism, of seeking the wisdom and heroism of ordinary people, and in this case, seeking it in those who died on 9/11. These stories were then a kind of link to the past, a link to an earlier era of political and cultural appreciation in New York City. It was not at all surprising to me that when I went to the September 11th Memorial Concert on September 11, 2002 in Central Park, that the bulk of the music was music of the New Deal era, music of the Popular Front, the New York of Fiorella LaGuardia, the New York of the Brooklyn Navy Yard during World War II. The event began with fanfare for the common man. It included several compositions by Aaron Copland, pieces by Duke Ellington, and songs that recalled the New York City of mid-century. Again, this is not a city that's forgetting its past, but very deliberately and selectively drawing on pieces of its past to cope with a new situation. Finally, we come to the elements of memory, because how portraits of grief remembered people was significant too, especially in the way it remembered dead firefighters, police officers, and rescue workers. Again, we see a kind of highly individualized form of memory. The dead firefighters, for example, are not recalled just for their official roles in uniform, but also as sons, daughters, husbands, parents, and friends. Their public roles are not seen as enough to explain and sanctify their lives. Their private lives loom equally important in explaining them to the world. And in this, we see a trend in remembrance of the dead that's been clearly visible since the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. In that memorial, in the original memorial, the design was simply for the names of soldiers who died in Vietnam. True, conservative critics of that memorial demanded a flagpole and realistic representations of soldiers in Vietnam alongside it. But when you go to the memorial, what's most striking, and this has been going on for many years now, is that people insist on leaving painfully personal items at the place where a dead soldier's name is marked. Letters, toys, flowers, medals, sporting goods. The absolute meaning of these items is often known only to the person who left them. Yet there is an insistent need for people to do this, and they do. In these kinds of ways of remembering, the collective and the individual are both expressed, and they tug at each other, and they gain definition from each other. Neither one alone, it seems, suffices to explain and sanctify the loss of a human life to people. The collective and the individual are needed together. The best example of this I know of is in the funerals of firefighters in the New York City region in the days after September 11th. Firefighters' funerals, police officers' funerals are a staple of media culture in the New York metropolitan area. They mark the deaths of people who die often heroically, saving us and protecting us. They are also enormously telegenic, and they command television attention. They also, I must add, lead to a misunderstanding of who has a dangerous job. There are quite a few jobs, commercial fishermen, coal miner, and others, that are more dangerous than being a police officer or a firefighter. And transit workers die in similar numbers to police officers and firefighters, but their funerals don't get the pageantry and attention. Nonetheless, the funerals for firefighters were an enormous presence on the television screens in the days, weeks, and months of September 11th. And they're very, very striking for what they reveal about elements of old ways of commemorating death and new ways of commemorating death. The historian George Mossy looked at the Vietnam War Memorial in D.C. and concluded that there was no longer any good public death, that the nation, religion, ideology, no longer served to sanctify people's deaths in war, but rather it was as lonely individuals that we confronted this sacrifice. In the funerals of firefighters, we see something different. We see a tug between traditional ways of marking the death of a firefighter and much more personal ways of marking the death of a firefighter. Again, this tension between the collective and the individual. I interviewed one of the protocol directors of the New York City Fire Department about the evolution of firefighters' funerals. It's been changing over roughly the last 10 years and very visibly since September 11th. And then I went to the funeral of one firefighter who died at the World Trade Center, Michael Kiefer of Long Island. And it was very striking to me to see how the traditional elements of a firefighter's funeral, which usually were just represented by memorabilia and signs from the department, now blended with elements of a more personal nature to mark that firefighter's passing. For example, firefighter Kiefer's coffin was brought to the church on the back of a fire truck, preceded by a pipe band, both very traditional elements in a firefighter's funeral. Yet also in that procession was his SUV and a surfboard on top, because Michael Kiefer was a surfer, and his family members insisted that although you needed to know that Michael was a firefighter, you also needed to know that he was a surfer to understand the totality of who he was. When you went inside the church, there was the Maltese cross, the traditional symbol of the fire department at the front of the church, but there was also a floral surfboard. There were psalms and a traditional Roman Catholic service to mark firefighter Kiefer's death. There was also the singing of a song written in the aftermath of the World Trade Center disaster called New York's Damn Bravest, which draws very heavily on the singing style of Tommy Makem and the Clancy Brothers to commemorate the sacrifice of firefighters on September 11th. The mourners who came to the church, and they came in the hundreds from all around the region, wore very somber black traditional funeral clothing. Yet many of them were wearing buttons with Michael Kiefer's picture on it and Michael Kiefer's name on them. It wasn't enough that they attend the funeral. It wasn't enough that they wear traditional mourning garb, but they obviously felt compelled to commemorate Michael in a deeply individual way by attaching his picture to their bodies as a gesture of grief and solidarity. These are the kinds of themes that loomed large in the lives of New Yorkers and all people all around the state and region after September 11th. It's not that no one ever felt grief before. It's not that no one ever felt solidarity before. It's not that no one ever mourned before. But the point is, we mourned our dead in specific ways in the aftermath of September 11th. And if we look at those specific ways and compare them to the way we mourned the dead in other times, we can begin to understand something about the event itself, the world we live in at the time of this event, and how it represents either a continuity with the past or a departure from previous custom. And that helps us locate ourselves in time. It's through the practices that I've talked about, survivor stories in the newspapers, portraits of grief in the New York Times, and the firefighters' funerals that went out over television news programs, that New Yorkers mixed elements of the present and the past to cope with a new tragedy in the life of their city.